She's early. We're gaveling in early.
Are we gaveling in early? 1 minute.
7:59.
Jenny. But I'm here.
7:59. 7:59.
Capital Investment Committee will come to order. The technology isn't working so well, but it's a good thing we're used to using paper and supporting the industries of northern Minnesota and all of the workers across the state that work in the paper printing industry. And so we have them before us, and today is an exciting day because for the first time before the bonding committee is the new president of the University of Minnesota, Ms. Gable. Welcome, Dr. Gable.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Would you like me to begin?
Please.
Good morning, everybody, members of the House Capital Investment Committee. It's delightful to be with you this morning. Very glad to be here. I would like to express the university's appreciation to the committee staff also for their help in our work, and to all of you for taking the time to tour our Duluth and Twin Cities campuses to learn more about our projects and priorities this session. We're very grateful for the hours you spent on these tours, the focus you've placed on higher education, and your collaboration and partnership as we enter into the session. I'd also like to recognize Regent Mike Kenyanya, who's here on behalf of the Board of Regents. And any others who may arrive while we are conversing this morning, as well as several members of the university's executive team. Members of the committee, as you know, this is my first legislative session as president of the University of Minnesota, and I'm delighted to get started on this good work together. Today, on behalf of the university, I extend a simple message. Our university is committed to serving the state at top-notch levels, but we need top-notch facilities that match our capabilities and the ambitions of our students. And robust state support is the best way to make that possible. Our top priority is to restore existing facilities by undertaking renovation and improvement projects across the university. Asset preservation is amongst the most cost-effective uses of bonding dollars, and by ensuring the longevity of our buildings, we can prevent costly teardowns and replacement projects in the years ahead. State funding for capital projects has lagged behind, which has led to a massive maintenance backlog on our campuses. The 10-year need at the University of Minnesota tops $4.8 billion. Our need will only increase the longer our aging facilities go without funding, as one half of our buildings are 50 years old or older. And this includes our campuses in the metro, in greater Minnesota, our research and outreach centers, and our field stations. The state's investment is not only crucial to reversing these trends, but it's also a winning proposition. It's an investment in the future of our state, from our workforce-ready graduates to our life-changing and life-saving discoveries and cures, to our $9 billion annual economic impact. And it's an investment in our facilities and our infrastructure, which then allows us to use operating dollars to enhance student experience and to make our institutions more accessible and more affordable for all Minnesotans. By fulfilling our capital request this session, the state can set us on a sustainable budgetary path for the future. So to this end, we have some specific requests we would like to bring before you. First, we are requesting $200 million in HEPA funding, which will be utilized for projects across the system. Second, we're requesting $29.2 million to renovate and modernize the Child Development Building on the Twin Cities campus. This building is home to the number one nationally ranked developmental psychology program, which is a wonderful program and holds this top ranking despite the current condition of the facilities and the lack of classroom space in the building. But that's not a sustainable trajectory, and it will be harder for us to maintain that quality and that edge under the current infrastructure conditions. Third, we're requesting $4.4 million to modernize A.B. Anderson Hall on the Duluth campus. This is a 36,000 square foot facility that provides critical teaching space for more than 4,500 students in areas such as communications, philosophy, history, and art. Fourth, we're requesting $65.6 million to create a 100,000 square foot undergraduate chemistry laboratory. This space will support 3,300 students and 18 active learning laboratories, providing space for collaboration, lab prep, and academic support in this critical pipeline program for all of the STEM fields. And then lastly, we're requesting $18 million to design a new patient and participant-friendly clinical research facility on the Twin Cities campus. This will improve access to advanced treatments and state-of-the-art care for patients and their families, and it provides additional support for the more than 1 million people that the university cares for annually. So members of the committee, in closing, our 2020 capital request demonstrates the university's commitment to scholarship and discovery. It expands the learning opportunities for our students, it expands our faculty's research capabilities, and it expands access to clinical care for all Minnesotans. This investment in our facilities is an investment in our impact and in our people, and it will only serve to grow the university's outsized economic contribution to the state of Minnesota, to the benefit of all of us. So we're very grateful for your support, and we look forward to working together to renew our university and therefore our state. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Berthelsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think as the tech management work, we'll be working through the presentation. I think you maybe had, looks like some of you have a black and white version. Pages are the same as the color one, so I'll just try to reference the page numbers as I go through the presentation. Thank you for your support of past appropriations for our capital investment. We've put that to good work. Today I want to talk to you about the process about how we got to this particular list of projects to put before you, and our capital planning process, and a little bit more detail about our HEPA requests in particular. The state request we bring before you today is a culmination of many months and years of strategic planning. This is on page 3 of the presentation. Internally, the U of M prepares a six-year plan annually as required by our Board of Regents policy, and the board approves it each fall. It is the official document that sets our direction for all capital planning and construction. Because we have limited resources and limited capacity for a project, we must ensure that our highest priorities are shown in this plan. And this is the tool that we use to build all of our state requests and our annual capital budgets. And in fact, its major purpose is to create the six-year plan, is to create this particular state capital request. On page 4, the six-year capital plan development is really driven by two things. Two primary drivers. First is mission priorities. These are gathered from our chancellors and deans and prioritized by our provost, the vice president for research, and the vice president for health sciences. Also, in addition to that, of course, we collect and analyze our facility needs from all our facility managers, knowing that we have to make sure, regardless of whether the program is accurate, we have to make sure it's a safe and productive facility. The mission and facilities needs are together looked at together and balanced against available resources to arrive at our six-year capital plan. On page 5, you can see the six-year plan priorities are the result of input from various stakeholders, including our senior academic leadership, the president, and the Board of Regents. Reducing our poor and critical space is a measure on our Board of Regents progress card, is a priority unto itself, but it also cuts across all the other priorities on this list, as we need to make sure we have good and strong facilities to support all of our programs. HEPA continues to be our smartest and most cost-effective investment toward this objective. It protects and extends the useful life of our investments made by Minnesota taxpayers through capital bonding and by students who pay tuition and by donors who give support to the university mission. Without HEPA, we will struggle to deliver on the priorities outlined here, and deferred renewal will continue to grow. So I've told my page number and point of you are not the same one. So I'll point at the picture, maybe.
Nice picture.
Not how that works. We're into that one. Addressing deferred renewal is our number one priority for the university. And we aspire to be a top university across the nation and across the world. We cannot achieve and or sustain that, however, with overdue investments in our facilities. To keep pace with the needs of the university, the university should be investing more than double what we are today in renewing our physical assets. So if we look at the chart that says higher education share of bonding bill, Minnesota higher education between the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State has enjoyed strong partnership with the state over the past two decades, but we are seeing a challenging trend. Back in the early 2000s, higher education was receiving nearly 40% of the general obligation portion of the bonding on average. But recently, higher education share of that portion GO bonds is now about 30%, and actually below that. This decline is putting increased pressure on the University of Minnesota to defer more and limp along, which is neither sustainable, practical, or prudent. Our purpose here today is to ask you your support in reversing this trend. So now we look at the 10-year need table. I want to share the impact of underinvestment at the University of Minnesota and how we go about managing our campus renewal. And our process is that the university partners with independent assessment company to conduct periodic facility condition assessments for every campus across the state in every one of our buildings, looking at every component, be it building exterior, the mechanical system, the electrical system, the plumbing, all the way through. Assessments cover all the major building systems, and the result is to tell us about the relative health of our buildings, which parts are needing investment now, and when other pieces will be due. This process provides a very reliable industry standard objective analysis of what we have and what condition it's in. The result of our independent facility condition assessment process are described in the table. You can see the categories. It gives you a sense of our current replacement value if we were building the same exact building today. It gives you a sense of a deferred renewal, how much we should have been done already as of today that we should have been done and completed already. The third column is gives a sense our projection of what our need is coming in the next 10 years, and then you add that all together, it's our 10-year projected need. If we move on to the title renewal investment versus target, we know how much we need and when we need it and where we should invest it properly. This chart helps compare investments over the last decade against how much we should be investing. The bottom of the yellow range or bar shows the minimum needed to sustain our status quo, the same ratio of our relative health of our buildings. The top of the yellow line shows the annual amount needed to go beyond the minimum and start attacking the backlog of deferred renewal. We ask for $200 million a year in HEPR because that is our need. If we invest the minimum, we are not making any progress and may even be falling behind. Unfortunately, we have been missing this target almost every year and deferred more need than has gone to the backlog. We estimate that $600 million has been added to that deferred renewal backlog over the last 10 years. If we talk now, how do we make HEPR allocations, HEPR allocation across the state? In the years when the state does appropriate HEPR, we allocate dollars across the enterprise in a straightforward, equitable formula based on how much space each campus has and what condition that space is in. HEPR funding is guaranteed to reach all of our campuses. In addition to this formula, the Twin Cities periodically provides additional support to system campuses from central funds and HEPR funds that are converted from surplus funding on individual line item appropriations. So half of it is based upon how much space each campus is, half of it is based upon the facility condition assessment for each of the campuses, and that gives you an allocation, and you can see the dollar amounts by each of the campuses and the regional outreach centers across the state of Minnesota. We talked then about HEPR prioritization, the pie chart. Given our immense need and limited resources, we're careful with how every single dollar is invested. The facility condition assessment identifies the most critical projects and helps them lay them out in a timeline. But then we take an additional step. We use a building-by-building strategy to identify the most critical buildings. We categorize every building by whether it's a keep-up, it's in good condition, we want to keep it in that place, it's a building that's fallen into disrepair but we need to catch up, or it's a building we think we just need to sustain a level, or some buildings we've actually labeled do not invest because we are actively working on a way to take that building down. Buildings are assigned these categories and it helps us to put the proper amount of investment in each one of them. And it helps to make sure we are using those dollars most efficiently and wisely. And once the pressing projects have been put in those buildings, we consider several other factors to arrive at our final list, including criticality of the facility condition, the risk assessment to the people and programs in that building, the health and safety of that category, regulatory requirements, and program impact. The HEPR report that we give you annually, we have done since 2014 to 2019, the state of Minnesota has provided an approximately $110 million of HEPR funding to the university. 98% of that has been spent, encumbered, or otherwise obligated. This has supported over 110 projects in 85 buildings across all campuses across the state, supporting more than 225 local architects, engineers, and contractors of the state of Minnesota. We are ready, willing, and able to put every penny you give us to work. Our track record has been to have about 90% of the total appropriation spent, encumbered, or otherwise obligated within 2 years of the bill. More than $30 million of this 2020 HEPA request is already fully designed and ready to bid. In addition, less than in 6 months, another $130 million of projects would be completed, designed, ready to bid, and the rest would be ready within 12 months.
That concludes our report, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Gable and Mr. Berthelsen. On page four, the higher ed share of bonding bills, that graph, is that for both systems, the university system as well as the state system?
Madam Chair.
Or is it just at the university?
Madam Chair and members, that is for both Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota.
And I didn't quite get it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, members.
I heard what you said, but I don't quite get the chart.
So the dark line represents for each of your bonding bills, what percent of the GO portion of that bill has been appropriated to higher education, the combination of both the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State. So from 2000, and the dotted line is just sort of an overall trend analysis. So the actual dollars and appropriations are the solid black line. And you can see in the 2018 bill, 25% of the, represents 25% of your GO fund allocation in the bonding bill was appropriated to higher education.
I see. Well, I just don't think we should pay a lot of attention to that graph because you said our bill, and this is the first time this committee has been doing our bill. And we haven't had a conferred capital investment bill for 10 years, with a real conference committee. And so I don't know that this committee should take up a lot of time thinking about that particular graph. But Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And it wasn't for lack of trying.
I'm making judgments here. I just said that let's not pay a lot of attention to that.
And I don't disagree with you. My question, Mr. Berthelsen, and I just want a clarification. I'm not sure if you misspoke or if this is what you meant. You said that for HEPA, you needed $200 million a year. Did you mean a year or a biennium?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, for us to keep even, it would be $200 million a year maintains the status quo of our overall facility investment. That's what prudent capital investment standards, best practices would say we should be investing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you for that clarification, but then you should have requested $400 million.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, good point. We hope to see you again next year.
Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought there'd be more questions, and I'd be further down the list. I want to just kind of point out, because when I glanced at it at first, ROCS is of course not the Rochester campus. Could you give the committee the description of that once again?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative, apologize for the acronym, Regional Outreach Center. So it's the Ag Extension for the farms in Waseca or Crookston or Morris. All the other parts of the university across the state of Minnesota.
And that, Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
Sorry, I got a little anxious.
That's okay.
And again, I'm aware of that, and I just want to make sure the committee highlighted that. And I do think it also highlights the innovative model that the campus down in Rochester has used, because the campus in Rochester doesn't show up, and actually in your testimony you said all campuses get HEPR money, but that's not true, because the Rochester campus doesn't get a nickel of even HEPR, if I'm assuming the, since we don't own any buildings down there, we haven't invested in those. And I do think it highlights a model, and I would love to see an analysis and kind of a cross comparison about how that innovative campus and how they've designed it and partnered with the private sector, how that campus stacks up when you divide out all those costs. And I'm assuming that the tuition reflects that a little bit in Rochester, because they have to possibly pay a little bit more because it's the private sector. But at the end of the day, I feel like it's potentially less state dollars, and I would love to see if it is an effective strategy to use. I would love to see more of our campuses across the state of Minnesota consider those models of a public-private sector model. The opportunities that has created to partner in our community with, you know, Mayo Clinic, obviously, and all the downtown community employers who are seeking students who can do internships, and those opportunities are there at their disposal. And I just can't help but believe that there's a lost opportunity on all these other campuses to create those same types of models across the board in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll just say, yes, you're correct. You're correct that Rochester, we don't have allocation of HEPR for Rochester because all of our space is leased. Any renewal of those their facilities is then for paid in the operating budget for us through the leases. So you're right there, that obligation. And that is a model that we are paying attention to as well, and looking for where are those partnerships. The Rochester campus certainly in a unique spot in the middle of downtown Rochester, where we could benefit from a lot of private sector investment and facility opportunity. So that is a model we are paying attention to, as well as for the future of the Rochester campus as it grows. So thank you for that feedback.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you so much again. And again, I love the model. I think it is innovative. I think it's created dual opportunities for the students, the school, and the community. And I really believe strongly in that. What I'm actually asking for, though, too, is some type of financial comparison, then cross comparison of all of those, kind of all of those costs, including the leases. And maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe it's costing the university system significantly more to do it this way. But I'd like to see that. And even if it is more, I think there's a public policy discussion to be had that still says it's still the right thing to do. It's still benefiting these students, the community, and the university exponentially more than if we were doing it in the old model. And again, I just would love some type of cross analysis to that, because it's like this one little experiment. I'm sorry, I'm talking faster. Too much coffee this morning. I'm talking faster than my mouth is moving. But I'm very excited about that model. I really do believe in it. And I think, as legislators, it's our one opportunity to kind of, if we highlight that and find that the solution is that there's more to it than just the fact that it happens to be in downtown Rochester, because obviously our Minneapolis and St. Paul campuses are kind of well positioned for this type of modeling as well. And sometimes we're so hung up on the bricks and mortar and naming buildings and thinking that that's going to be the best thing for the legacy of the university. The reality is the best thing for the university would be to offer those opportunities to students that we wouldn't get if we had a Rochester campus out by the airport or something like that. Those opportunities wouldn't exist, and I think we really need to strategize and focus on creating those opportunities for people where the opportunities are.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Pearson's comments. I think cost of education to students should be considered as you evaluate that, because we know that, you know, the cost of higher education is becoming less and less attainable for middle-class Minnesotans and middle-class Americans, and anything that might like benefit the university's bottom line as a whole but increases student tuition even 3 or 4%, I think is something to be concerned about. But that's not my question. My question is regards to those buildings that go in transition from very costly to repair and maintain. When they cross that line to no longer worth it, we need to tear the building down, it needs to be replaced. Have you all done any analysis over the past decade or so what that might have looked like if an appropriate amount of HEPR money had been invested in those buildings? You know, sort of like, you know, this building now is a $20 million building to replace, whereas if 10 years ago we would have gotten $1 or $2 million for that building, we could have been able to keep that building in use and long into the future. Have you done any analysis regarding that?
Mr. Burstelson.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we have some, there's some industry standard models that would say every dollar of renewal saves $3 later if it gets to a place where things break. We have case studies. We don't have a long history of research on our campus, but we know that that good maintenance and good renewal on a timely basis is always more cost effective than when it when something breaks and is unexpected and you have to deal with it then. That's many times cheaper. We know that industry says, again, a dollar of a good investment will save three if it's too delayed. We also know that maintaining a build, the cheaper, renewing a building is always going to be cheaper than building a new one in the same place if you can renew it in a way that still maintains that program. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I think that's an interesting sort of thing, and I think the industry standards, all that's great, but you have an incredible student population at the university, and I can just envision a joint project between someone in the finance area, whether it's MBA program or something like that, the architecture program and engineering, actually like doing a case study on a particular building that has been moved out of service because of the cost of repair has greatly outweighed the cost of construction, to maybe go back and look at what the ask was for that building. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just sounds like a great learning opportunity.
Representative Constine.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to express the same concern that Representative Dean did. At a time of immense student debt, adding on to that doesn't seem to be a direction that we'd like to go. I think he made the point, though.
Representative Salk.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a couple of the old political thing is, you know, I got wonderful things to say, but it seems that somebody else has said them, so I'm not going to repeat them. I'll change the phrase just a little bit. To Representative Pearson's point, I think there is much more than just the financial analysis. I, as a person who has lived there, was at very first meetings in terms of the community, that this is the way we would like to propose that we solve this ongoing challenge and need for our university in Minnesota. We have now lived into that a way, so we think there's enough time here that it's worth reporting it out. And I honestly, I have to say that I haven't seen anything that would be the kind of robust reporting that I would expect, first of all, to understand it, and second of all, to then be able to compare it. There's other things that are going on down there that are because of the change of paradigm. So I'm using that word specifically on purpose, because not only when you look through a different window, look through a different place to see something different, are you going to even know that it was there. And in this case, I think that's really true, because most people will have no clue that there's revolutionary understanding of how to teach going on in Rochester that is not maybe somewhere else. And it's been promulgated primarily because all the staff looks through this new window, a new way of understanding an institution, and clearly that is a different animal down there. I agree with Representative Pearson that the financial analysis on lease and all of those factors is so different
that it causes people to then think differently. And I think that that's worth being able to see. And we've got architects here on this group, and I know that they would be, sometimes they would say that, yes, that's true. How it's designed, how it's built, changes the way people can live and think in there. Then they would also challenge it because they would say that that's not everything. It is a related element of why that place is different and why it's of value. There may be someday that we learn, oh, yeah, that was a wonderful little story, fairy tale that we had down in Rochester, and I'm sorry, but we need to go back to these institutions that are I'm becoming judgmental of the these monuments that we create, both to ourselves. I'm an alumni. I get the regular letter saying, wouldn't you like to give a big chunk of money? We will somehow make that known, you know, and we get our pride and our egos wrapped up in bad thinking. There is nothing inherently great about an all-granite building. It just looks wonderful for the donor, and it looks wonderful for the idea that history is going to move forward. So we do really have to change the paradigm of how we're looking at this stuff, and I think part of that happens in the reporting. Somebody smarter than me has said that what you report and or keep track of will drive what it is you're going to improve, and I think this is a very good case of that. I know that for a while it's been too new, and I would suspect there are faculty members, faculty leaders here at the university and in Minneapolis that think of it as, oh, that thing down there. They wouldn't have any idea to verbalize the concepts of what's different. So I know I went on and on and on about that, but I want to make the point to you guys that there is an opportunity to understand education differently, which is one of our challenges today, because as we trickle down into the high school, pre-baccalaureate type of educations, we're still struggling. I could have gone in and sat in the classroom for my daughters, who are about 40 years behind me, and they experienced the exact model that I did. Not a whit's difference in it. Now, they were in Rochester, and I was in Little Alden someplace. But that even speaks to the problem here, is that we're doing these same old things, the same over and over. And frankly, we know we're not doing it well. But nobody can break out of that. So anyway, there you go. Please report or start putting some metrics on why and how that is different down there.
Representative Salk, I bet you've never received a letter saying, please send us a big chunk of money from the university.
Well, my wife is a graduate, and we have.
I'm sure it was worded as a contribution, and I'm sure every contribution is appreciated, big or chunky. Representative Lilly, quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just mine's more of a quick comment. I just want to thank you and the previous chairs, and the U and Minsku, because for me, we get a lot of stuff on paper, but to actually get on campus are just really powerful. I wouldn't have really thought of like Anoka, you know, the problems out there in the Minsku system, and then like the child development building, had we not been in there. So it was really powerful for us to see that. And I think it's really, just testament to the tours. It's kind of neat to see, because one of your big projects is the chemistry building, for example, and then in Duluth, I was on the committee when we toured it, and then to see that being completed, so just to visualize that happening at the U in the metro here. And so it's just kind of neat to see the full cycle, and thanks for the tours. I think is really helpful for me as a member.
And remember, we learned from St. Lily that the Child Development Center is badly in need of a new building.
Right.
But this still program is number one in the nation.
Exactly.
And so you kind of have to figure that in there, too. Representative Cantrell, really quick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, President Gable, and Vice President Berthelsen.
Good.
So I just want to say I really think that there is a tremendous value to the economic stability and longevity of our state in ensuring that we do invest in our University of Minnesota and in our state college system. If our facilities are not world-class, if they are not on par with the rest of the country, then I think we stand to lose a significant portion of prospective student populations to other institutions. And I just wanted to say I did research at the University of Minnesota in Moose Tower. Would love to see that building be updated. And shout out to Dr. York Marrenz. In the long run, I really think it is important to emphasize that this is not only, if we invest now, it will not only be a tremendous cost savings to our state, but I think it will help to ensure that that our MinSCU system and that our University of Minnesota system continues to be a leader in post-secondary education and research and in moving Minnesota forward. So there's a reason why you can't spell cheaper without heaper. So that's...
Thank you very much. I don't want to go further with this any longer today, but at some point in time, I still want a better understanding of how the amount per campus of HEPR is formulated and is per capita on various campuses figured in with the per capita, or with the ending number of HEPR dollars that goes to particular campuses. And I want that in some kind of visual form that is easy to understand. And I was hoping we would get into that a little bit more today so that we had a better understanding of what goes into figuring it out. You gave us the general outline, but in particular, how is the money divided up, the $200 million divided up between your five campuses, and why at that particular time? And I know it can't be the same every year. And so if you can get that to us, or if we'll have extra time someday, we can call you back for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Minnesota State. And we welcome you, and we know that we're over time because we had philosophy classes today. Chancellor, welcome to this committee.
Jim Murphy, thank you for your shout out for liberal arts education. Much appreciated. Yes.
Benedictine trained.
Jim Murphy, members of the committee, thank you for your time today. I'm Devinder Malhotra, Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Joining me today is Brian Yolitz, Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities at Minnesota State, who will provide more details about the projects that our Board of Trustees have approved and now await your consideration. In addition, in the audience today, I'm joined by Vice Chair of our Board of Trustees, Roger Moe, a name very familiar in these August chambers. And also in the audience is Trustee Louise Sundin. Also in the audience, there are three presidents who are in the audience, and I would like, as I speak their name, with your indulgence, Chair Murphy, for my presidential colleagues to stand so you can put names and faces together. In the audience is Patricia Rogers, president of Lake Superior College, Ginny Arthur, president of Metropolitan State University, and Joe Mulford, president of Pine Technical and Community College. Again, Chair Murphy, I would like to begin by expressing my deep appreciation of your past support. We have to go behind the bricks and mortar. Because of your work, we have been able to complete some remarkable transformational infrastructure projects in communities across Minnesota that will benefit teaching and learning for decades to come. Because of your support, we were able to celebrate grand openings of buildings in several communities this past year, including Hibbing, St. Cloud, Rochester, Albert Lea, and Education Village in Winona. Thank you, Representative Pearson, Representative Sensted, and Representative Salk and Representative Vogelmont for joining us. Representative Bennett joined us too, but I noticed she's not in the room as yet. But if I have missed anyone, please accept my apologies. Your presence was much appreciated. Madam Chair, I would also like to acknowledge the work of this committee and your excellent staff. Minnesota State appreciates the time you spent understanding Minnesota's infrastructure needs firsthand. Minnesota State was pleased to host the committee at many of our campuses, and I'm confident that along with our capital needs, you were also able to see the great work that our faculty and staff do every day in meeting the needs of our students and those of our communities. In a bonding book you should have in front of you, I would like to highlight some information for your consideration. If you turn to page 3, I understand that many of you have seen this before, but I do think it's important to reflect a bit on the size and scope of the work of Minnesota State. Each year, we serve over 350,000 students. Of these 350,000 students, about 240,000 students are enrolled in our degree-granting programs. We have 63,000 students of color or those of Native origin enrolled in our colleges and universities. We have well over 75,000 students who come from low-income families. We have close to little over 80,000 students who are 25 years or over. We have close to 48,000 students who are first-generation college entrants and close to 10,000 veterans in our colleges and universities. We are proud that of our 38,000 graduates last year, close to 20,000 students graduated from our two-year career and technical programs, and 87% of the graduates find a job in their field of study and stay in Minnesota. Our physical space has a profound impact within our communities. On page 4, I would like to point out a couple of highlights about our footprint. Our roofs span 301 acres, and our very talented maintenance workers manage 2,600 different pieces of HVAC equipment throughout all four seasons in Minnesota. It's also important to note that Minnesota State represents about one-third of the total square footage of the state public buildings. The last point I want to make can be found on page 5 of your book. This chart illustrates the large expansion of Minnesota State facilities in the 1970s. This is why asset preservation and replacement, or as we fondly refer to it as HEPR, is consistently the Board of Trustees' number one priority. So many of our buildings are 50 years old or more. It is critical that we maintain them in order to keep our students, faculty, and staff safe, warm, and dry. I would also like to emphasize that we have a very inclusive process for developing the Board of Trustees list. It is driven by leaders across our campuses, and the projects you see before you are ranked in priority order following our HEPR request, which is our number one priority. Madam Chair, again, I would like to thank you for all your work over the past few months, and please know Minnesota State wants to be your partner in passing a robust capital investment bill this legislative session. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee.
Thank you, Doctor. We really appreciate your hospitality, too, during the tours. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. I just wanted to very quickly say how nice it is to go into Minnesota State Mankato's library now and not get rained on.
Hope not.
Well, it was before, and that was a HEPA request.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Thank you. I'm sure our students, faculty, and staff appreciate it as much as you do.
Mr. Yolitz.
Good morning, Madam Chair Murphy and committee. I'm Brian Yolitz, and I serve the colleges and universities of Minnesota State as Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities. First, I'd like to add my thanks and appreciation to each of you for your time and attention visiting so many of our campuses this past fall. Your engagement with our students, faculty, and campus leaders was remarkable, and I trust that brought you in touch with the human aspects of our capital request. Perspectives, I believe, will serve you well in the coming weeks. I'll be going using the slide deck that's kind of in your hands there, going to the kind of the overview. This morning, I'll do a brief recap of our capital bonding request for the session. Then, as requested, go through some details of our HEPA methodology, specifically how we identify facility asset preservation needs and our strategies to address them in our project list. And then finally, I'll touch base on the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program and our experience at some of our colleges and universities that we've had utilizing that tool. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll take any questions during the testimony unless you'd rather hold them till the end.
We can, if there are, there won't be too many.
Okay. Then turning to the slide, Minnesota State 2020 capital request. Our request is for $271.2 million capital program funded with $230.8 million in general obligation or GO bonding and $40.4 million in user financing. On pages 6 and 7 of the bonding book, you'll find the prioritized list of this request. The number one priority is $150 million for asset preservation or HEPR to address the most pressing stewardship needs of our colleges and universities. Below HEPR is a priority order are 15 campus-specific projects totaling $121.2 million. You visit a vast majority of these projects during your tours this past fall. Priority projects 2 through 5 received $14.5 million in the 2018 bonding bill for initial design and phase one renovation work. All are ready for 2020 funding to move into the next phase of construction. Priority 6 through 9, the design of future renovations at St. Paul College, design and renovation of existing buildings at Minneapolis College, Vermilion Community College in Ely, and the Brainerd campus of Central Lakes College, as well as the East Grand Forks campus of Northland Community and Technical College, were all in the 2018 bonding request. They had early support on in the session, but ultimately didn't make the final bonding bill. Priority 11 at MSU Mankato through Priority 16, which I want President Mulford to know that I'm reminding everybody that that is at Pine Technical College. It's on our list, even though it's at number 16, have been in campus plans for some time and are now new for your consideration this session. More details about this request are in the following pages of the bonding book, including an overview of our HEPA program on pages 8 and 9 and an outline of campus asset preservation priorities addressed within this request on pages 10 through 13. And the following pages, 14 through 21, provide highlights of the individual college university projects in the request in priority order. Turning then to the HEPA methodology slide, Madam Chair and members, focusing on our HEPA management methodology, we first turned to Minnesota State Statute 135A46, entitled Asset Preservation and Replacement. Their authorized work for HEPA funding is outlined, ranging from correcting health and safety issues to include enhancing access and compliance with Americans with Disabilities Act and hazardous material abatement, implementing best practices to enhance energy efficiency, preserving building interiors and exteriors, building renewal to support existing missions of facilities, and then finally to do design work for future HEPA projects. From these, we get the mantra of warm, safe, and dry, and I think, Madam Chair, you added current in one of our hearings earlier this session, I think the very first one. And our friends at MMB would remind us that all of this work must be capital in nature and for a public purpose. So we make sure that we have pretty strict guidelines coming from both the statutes as well as from policy from MMB. Turning next to assessing needs, the slide. Building upon the statutory guidance, we have three complementary practices or tools for assessing facility conditions. Campus leaders are continually assessing how the condition and configuration of our campus facilities support their current and future academic programs and student needs. These plans are formalized and documented on a five-year cycle in college and university comprehensive facilities plans. Also, annually, our campus facilities directors assess the condition of their facilities with a focus on facility systems and the building envelope. The results are loaded into our facilities condition management tool called VFA Facility, a nationally utilized facilities management package, which integrates basic facility data such as building age, type of construction, purpose, with the annual assessment information for modeling and reports at both the campus and system level. Then moving to the meet need slide, college and universities then go about the business of resourcing and executing on the plan priorities. Some work, given its urgency, size, and complexity, is addressed through campus general operating funds made up of student tuition and state appropriation. Our goal for institutions are to invest about $1 a square foot on average over a three-year period. Recent history shows us that the campuses have invested about $1.50 per square foot over the last 3 years. For bigger, more complex work in our academic facilities, we turn to capital bonding from the state. Asset preservation for conforming to state statute are pursued through HEPR. We also can accomplish HEPR-like work in major capital projects. If you recall our visit to Vermilion Community College in Ely, we talked about replacing the roof as part of that project. We don't want to have the great classrooms and lab spaces with a leaky roof over the top. So we package them together for your consideration. And there are some cases where we can address this work through alternative means, including grants and special gifts, some capital campaigns by our campuses, as well as the guaranteed energy savings program that I'll touch on shortly. In terms of turning them into the physical plant slide, as Chancellor Malhotra outlined, who happens to be our biggest HEPR cheerleader, he talked about in his introduction about two-thirds of our academic facilities were built in the 1970s or earlier. While there has been some investment in these buildings, many of their components have gone untouched. Then turning to asset preservation funding, we've received HEPR funding in several of the last bonding years since 2012. However, it simply hasn't kept up with our needs nor our aging buildings. You'll see on the next slide a backlog of maintenance. As a result of our backlog of maintenance now is approximately $1 billion, and this backlog reflects the facility components like roofs and exteriors, boilers and HVAC systems and utility systems that are now obsolete, having exceeded their useful lives, and are now in what we call backlog status. Then turning to assessment output, looking to the future over the next 10 years, between 2020 and 2029, we expect another $1.3 billion worth of facility components and systems to reach the end of their useful lives. Together, they represent a $2.3 billion 10-year asset preservation need for Minnesota State academic facilities. Turning then to slide 11, which is the HEPR management slide, in preparation for the legislative session, we ask our college and university leaders to review their facilities plans, assessment results and reports, and prioritize their asset preservation needs for our bonding request. Then in terms of the next slide, slide 12, those requirements are then forwarded to the system office, my staff, the facilities unit, where we integrate all the inputs based on some core elements, starting with campus priority, then followed by facility condition index, or FCI, that you heard Mike Berthelsen talk about. If the project has had some initial design funding from a prior session, which we have several projects in that at state and ready for construction now, as well as trying to strike a balance between colleges and universities and individual sectors, as well as institutions in metropolitan area, as well as greater Minnesota. We also consider the qualitative factors found in state statute, how impactful or how critical is the system that we're concerned about in case of a catastrophic failure. Would it shut down the campus altogether, or are there alternative means to serve that need? The availability of potential outside funds, such as grants, or any unique or special academic program that the work would be supporting. Together, they represent our best thinking given our understanding of the campus conditions and priorities at the time. When a bonding bill is actually passed and funding is provided, we reach back out to college and universities and reaffirm their priorities to make sure the campus facility conditions and priorities haven't changed in the 6 to 9 months since we made that initial list, and utilize the same core elements and qualitative factors to align funds with priority projects. After disbursing HEPR funds to our college and universities, we oversee the design work and project execution and funds use, moving any bid savings and reapportioning them to the next priority or where shortfalls may have occurred in the bidding process to make sure that we're capturing any emerging college or university needs. Any questions on that process? Then turning to the to complement asset preservation, we've taken advantage of the GESP or Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, and you'll see it on slide 14. That's an alternative to capital financing through the state of Minnesota, and we've used that at several places that you witnessed at Riverland Community College. Authority for the GESP is found in state statute, and Governor Wall's Executive Order 1925 provides some additional direction in terms of how that program is managed and administered. The Department of Commerce oversees the state's GESP, providing master contracting tools and technical expertise. And frankly, there's no way we could do an energy savings contract as effectively as Commerce has laid out, given our current staffing and our structure within Minnesota State. And we're grateful for their support in making this happen. I should note that not all asset preservation needs can be addressed in through the GESP, as there are very specific payback periods and some technical and financial requirements that I think the Department of Commerce will talk about when they get an opportunity to testify before the committee. On slide 15, you'll see some of the examples of where we have executed guaranteed energy savings programs through energy savings contracts. You saw the one at Riverland Community College during your visit to Austin. Others that are in place or are under development are at MSU Mankato and the two campuses of Hennepin Technical College and at Winona State University. At MSU Mankato, the project basically addressed some $8.5 million worth of work, energy savings improvements, saving approximately the university about $400,000 in annual energy costs. Those costs then are utilized to pay the lien against the equipment and materials that was, or the loan that was established for the work. And they also, the university also received the 2018 Minnesota Clean Energy Community Award from the Department of Commerce, so we're very proud of that and that the spearheaded work that the folks at MSU Mankato did. At our Hennepin Technical College, we've got a $3.9 million project there. We expect to save around $200,000 a year. We're still in the process of implementing energy saving measures at that campus, mostly lighting, to make sure that we've got quick return on our investment and to pay that debt back on the notes.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Yolitz. I've got a quick question. When I look at the capital budget priority list, and you know, of course, HEPR is on top. Should you not get all the money you request? When you look at HEPR, I'm assuming that each building has a list of priorities within the building that project. Do you like draw a hard line and you do the HEPR on, you know, 100% on, you know, the buildings on the list that you go through? Or do you look at some of the other buildings and say, this is a real, real big priority, so we're going to address that now, even though we don't have enough money to do all of that, and as a result, another building might not get all of its repairs done? I mean, does that make sense, or was it kind of convoluted question?
Mr. Yolitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, that's the exact dilemma that Mr. Berthelsen and I have at every time the bonding bill is passed, is how do we fit the right projects at the right campuses and the right buildings in to the monies that we have available. And it's as much as we try to be as objective as possible, but there are some times when we say, I can't invest all that I'd want to in a facility to replace an entire boiler system and its distribution system, because it'll take an enormous size of the monies we've been apportioned. I need to get more money to more campuses, so I'm going to forego that and do some other projects. So yes, that there is an issue with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Yulitz. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I think that's all I've got. I think there's some other questions.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chancellor, and for coming by to present. And I just want to echo Representative Lilly with regards to his remarks around having us on campus to really see and hear from the students and centering our students first. And with that, I do want to, echo the question that Representative Murphy has for the University of Minnesota with regards to your decision-making process as to how you go into deciding which one are your priorities. And this is from my experience when we first got to Anoka Ramsey, and having seen and heard from one of those nursing student who, was having undergoing a unstable housing situation where she will have to come to campus, study, and then have to go back in time to do her chores so that she could remain in the shelter. And then going throughout the state of Minnesota where we see these campuses with all these great new technologies. And I wonder, looking at the demographics of our student bodies, are that considered within the decision-making process where, we have students who are coming from different life experiences. And then I think this ties back to the point that Representative Pearson and Representative Salk was making too. When we think about, how are we going with regards to our facilities, I think that for many who are first-generation students like myself, having that college experience is important for us. And so how do we weigh in, cost saving? But in addition to that, how do we factor into the decision-making process the experience for folks who may not have traditionally been in that setting? And so just want to hear from you and, for the University of Minnesota to follow up with us too. How do we balance the demographics of our student body too, for the University of Minnesota? How do we balance the students at Morris and Crookston compares to the experience that our students at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities are experiencing?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, great question. And indeed, all of those considerations to go in, we have a very elaborate process by which we determine our priority set. I will let in a minute Brian Yulitz walk you through that. But it's very important that the voices of the students and their needs and also those of our individual campuses are brought into that allocative process and that priority setting processes. Because indeed, as you point out, we have 37 heterogeneous institutions with very varying student demographics, with different locational contexts, with different history and culture, with different programmatic orientation, and all of those factors play into it. But Mr. Yulitz can walk you through that process.
Mr. Yulitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, indeed, our Board of Trustees establishes before any bonding cycle a set of guidelines of what they want to see in their capital request. And HEPR's a bit of a different animal, but I'll talk to the individual projects that you talked about at Anoka Ramsey Community College. Our guidelines from our Board of Trustees talks about the very things you talked about. What are the student population that we want to make sure that we're uplifting first-generation students? Are there opportunities for us to make sure that they got a baccalaureate pathway away from a two-year to a four-year degree? And those guidelines then inform what we have called is our scoring process. So we have all of our college universities submit, not all of them, but many of them submit individual line item projects for the board's consideration. Last cycle, we had some 25 projects submitted. Our scoring process, because we can't ask for everything, we know there's some due diligence and some stewardship required in these scarce capital dollars. So we used those very elements as part of our scoring rubric that it decided what projects needed to go forward. And that's why you see Anoka Ramsey Community College on the very top. One of the aspects was the students they serve. Another aspect was the fact that they had some funding for design last legislative session. They got funding last legislative session because of the scoring again, because of the students that they serve. So I think our Board of Trustees is very attuned, and it gives us very good direction in that regard to make sure that we're getting money to the right places.
Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
last question.
And this is more of a higher level question, I guess, for Chancellor Malhotra and President Gabel, if you want to chime in as well. A lot of Minnesotans probably don't realize that we have the two separate educational systems, the university system and the Minsky system. And from an educational standpoint, a little competition is probably good. If one system improves one of their academic areas, then it might raise the bar for the other academic system to match that. And the end result of that is good for the employers of the state of Minnesota, because the education of those students is better. But there can't help but be a little competition as well when it comes to the dollars, to the HEPR dollars, and to the other projects. So my question is, do you have any examples of how the two systems are able to share resources, work together? Is there a cost savings there? Is that even allowed under our current system?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll defer to Mr. Yolitz to give you the examples, but to your broader question, I think the state of Minnesota is very fortunate to have very vibrant two public higher education systems. And I am thrilled, I was thrilled when President Gabel, when she came on board, she reached out to me, and we have met regularly in looking precisely for where we can work together and take ownership of learning of all our students, no matter which system they are enrolled in. I'm thrilled and delighted the way those conversations are proceeding. So you will see more of that. I think there are many various areas where we cooperate even right now. I think the only place we draw the line is ice hockey.
What?
But I know, for example, even beyond physical infrastructure, we cooperate very well in the realm of providing, in the realm of information technology and cybersecurity. In fact, one of our colleges is, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Yolitz can correct me, Itasca Community College is on the land which is owned technically by University of Minnesota. So there are many such examples there, but I will let Mr. Yolitz give you some additional examples if he has, and then with your indulgence, Madam Chair, we can invite President Gabel, if she's still here, yes, to answer for, to talk, answer for herself and respond to your question.
We have reached the end of our time, but Mr. Yolitz, you can give us the example if you have it.
Sure. Chancellor Malhotra could read my scribbling. So indeed, Itasca Community College up in Grand Rapids is a great example of close partnership. Something I think that Chancellor Malhotra mentioned is unique missions, and sometimes those missions are pretty far apart. I mean, broadly higher education, research focus. One opportunity that's kind of in the incubation stage right now is around agriculture in southeast part of the state. We're working together. Arbor Riverland Community College is working with the college at the University of Minnesota on how they may do a better job of serving the agricultural research needs of the state of Minnesota. That's in its very infancy, and I think that's something that this committee would be interested in looking at in the future. A lot of work to do in that area, but I think there's some opportunities there.
I think you hit on it, Representative Jurgens, that this is the way to go.
Saving the best for last.
Saving the best for last. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Chancellor and President. There's still more to come about the Energy Savings Program, not only for the colleges and universities of our state, but for any agency of our state. And this has just come up through the tours that we had, that we needed a little more information about the energy savings program and how it was established, and that we had testimony to that already today, and we have information about the original statute that created it, and Governor Dayton signing it, and so if you can start from that point, then you won't have been cheated out of all your time.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am grateful for your time and interest in this. My name is Catherine Blauvelt. I serve as Assistant Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources within the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In that role, I work on energy policy and also across agencies, and there are several that are partners with us on this project. And I'd love to have my colleague Michelle introduce herself.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I am Michelle Granzi. I serve as the Director of the State Energy Office. The Guaranteed Energy Savings Program is under my purview now, just as of July.
So we've already heard a great deal about the capital needs that the state and its public institutions have, and I'm here to share information on a tool that state-owned buildings, tribes, municipalities, and our higher education institutions can opt to use to leverage private financing to improve their energy efficiency, save money, address those deferred maintenance needs, and hopefully create some good jobs in the process. And that's the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. So you have your PowerPoint, which I will help step you through. We're moving on to the second slide. So you see here some of the features of the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program, along with a building that you're probably all quite familiar with that recently completed energy efficiency and some water conservation upgrades through the program. This is a Department of Commerce administered program that enables contracting and financing to implement cost-effective energy savings and renewable energy as well projects. Quickly, some fundamentals on the program. Thank you for the background on the origins already. We have 11 pre-qualified energy services companies, right, under a master contract, and that has their standard documents underneath that. The contract that they utilize with us is referred to as an energy savings performance contract. So here's how that works practically. The energy services company assumes the turnkey responsibility for doing project bidding, design, and implementation. So in other words, they're going to do the guts of the project, right? They're going to hire the subcontractors. They're going to scope out the project and ultimately conduct the work. That energy savings company provides to the entity that they're entering into the contract with a guaranteed maximum price, right, a cost, and an annual savings guarantee. So this is a critical feature, right, which the Department of Commerce oversees and helps verify. And then they take those fundamentals and they utilize third-party lease purchase financing. So that energy service company goes to the private market, right? So now we're out of the public sector, you know, bonding and appropriations box, and we're to a bank, right, or another private capital source, and we sign an agreement with them to finance the project. So those are the fundamentals. Scale is important. This really works best for projects over $1 million. I can scoot to the next slide. So again, it's unique in going outside of the public dollars that we've heard talk about. Here you have on the third slide, I'll note the dots represent some of the geographic areas where projects have occurred. We have some high-level results to date. Overall, around $33 million have been invested in guaranteed energy savings projects, and you see a total annual savings there. These are really complex projects. So you think about a project, we're always talking about multiple buildings within that project, right? And they might be over a geographic area. And they're all different, right? They all have different, you've seen some of them, different ages and different needs. So the amount of technical, financial, and contractual expertise is considerable. When we started the program, and I'd say still, a lot of folks aren't familiar, right, with the ability to take some of the deferred maintenance needs you have that have energy, potential energy savings with them and go out to the private market. So that's a continual education piece. Just to zoom out a level, Minnesota, so now we're talking about all public buildings, has 6,000 public buildings altogether with nearly 300 million square feet. Now, not all of those buildings, right, would be a fit for GESP, right? It really is a tool out of many that you're familiar with. But indeed, we know there is potential for additional savings. And then who GESP has helped, just to give you a flavor of it, and you've heard from Minnesota State, we've helped out a number of Minnesota State campuses, and Winona State is in the works. Two state agencies as well, DNR and Department of Administration, two cities, Bemidji I know is one, and then Indian Tribe Leech Lake did a whole bunch of buildings, tribal buildings for them. Great, next slide. So the next couple slides are going to just try to give you a sense of how the value of using this approach works or looks. So on the left, this pie chart, the left pie chart, you see kind of status quo, right? So that's what the building owner is paying for, right? Energy costs and maintenance. So what's important is these pies are going to stay the same, right? So you're not seeing any capital outlay. That's our goal with an energy savings project, is it's neutral from that perspective. But after the improvements, you'll see savings are gained, right, from the maintenance and the operations and the pieces of equipment you're putting in, right? You're going to be using less energy. You take those savings and they use them to repay for the capital improvements you just did, right? So those changes are paid for over time with the savings, and the entire transaction is budget neutral. So that's the... And Chair Murphy, I'm happy to take questions now, or I can keep.
So if we had language in the bond bill with more encouraging language that if the recipients of funding could have participated in this program, what would that do to your department or your part of the department?
Madam Chair, thank you for
if
the...
Could you handle it?
Could we handle it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Certainly, I will say, as we speak, and you heard from Minnesota State, which is obviously has a lot of bonding needs, they are, in fact, going to us, right, for those needs that could be perhaps alleviated through this tool, right?
Yeah.
So just want to acknowledge that that is happening. I'd need to obviously talk with the governor's office and others around the sort of changes to the bonding process. But as it stands, the project, this program was created without state appropriations for staff capacity. We have figured out workarounds in terms of utilizing grants that we've gone out and gotten, but to date, we are having difficulty with staffing.
With 85. But you only have 85, but you've got 6,000 opportunities out there, and there's only 85 buildings so far.
Right. So
how many more buildings with your present employees could you, how many more buildings could you take on?
So I think thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. I think the best way to answer that is to give you folks a little more on the guts of when the projects are, rather, a guaranteed energy savings project is the best fit. So it's not the best fit for every opportunity, every capital need. But I'll be sure to answer your question. The next two slides show the value of what the Department of Commerce is trying to bring to how we get more done, to answer your question, through the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. So we'll focus on this slide, we're on page 5, on this graph here. So this is just attempting to show you a conventional way to think about energy savings. The conventional way to be to look at the low-hanging fruit first, and a lot of people go to lights first, right? Lights are fluorescent, right? You replace them with an energy savings bulb. It's got a short payback. We all know that. So in a conventional approach, you'd use your existing funds to do that first, right? Pull that low-hanging fruit and get those immediate energy savings. But then you're left with trying to do private financing on other items that are probably bigger ticket, right? cost more, but also could have great energy savings just over a longer period of time. So I should say this data comes from an Oak Ridge National Laboratory study on the approach of an energy savings project. So if you then did that approach, the Oak Ridge determined you get about 76% of energy conservation measures done. That's what an ECM is, energy conservation measures. Now, if you go to the next slide, page 6, our approach with GASP is to flip that thinking and to actually leverage the short payback items to do more. So it's seed corn, right? Instead of just, sort of skimming the cream off, if I want to jump to another slightly ag analogy, right? So it's the seed corn that helps bring in the bigger deferred maintenance items that, your folks in, or the folks, say, in Minnesota State or others are saying, this system has got to be replaced. It's got to be upgraded. Well, you can get that done using this approach, leveraging those lights and other lower payback items to do the longer payback items. And that gets you to 96% of all possible measures done. It's a big number, bigger number, right? So that's good. I'll give you an example, and you were at Riverland, I understand, right? Mm-hmm. So they had a theater lighting that was in such shape that they actually limited staff access due to just safety, right? That had a 120-year payback. Just if you just did that particular, right? Not going to happen. But they were able to pair it through the GASP program, right, with other measures, brought down the overall cost and the overall payback time, and they were able to get that done. So this is also, I should say, about really, accessibility and comfort in the buildings and being able to look at all those things that you want to do and then bundle it in a way that leverages private capital to get it done. Next slide will help you see.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And since we were on Riverland, I think the question is, I understand the energy savings part of it and the efficiency and energy conservation. I think what we're interested in is generation. So when we went to Riverland, we saw the request for a whole new electrical system. And I understand that would be more efficient, if you do the energy conservation.
Mm-hmm.
But I also saw a lot of flat roofs. I saw a lot of turf grass. So with a climate crisis that we're in, should we look at distributed generation at these sites where you would produce the energy and pair that with the efficiency, where if you had solar on site and it reduces the energy cost that you're paying for the energy, makes it more efficient, you're also more redundant and not relying solely on the grid, you're separate, or not redundancy, but resiliency. You'd have more resiliency in the system if you have that distributed generation.
Thank you.
That's on the campuses, but separately, wastewater, that when we go to wastewater treatment plants, they also have a lot of flat roofs. They have a huge energy use. The buildings aren't very efficient, and it's my understanding that Met Council has done some solar on their wastewater treatment plants. And maybe if getting to the committee that information of how solar was put on and what that has done for generation in reducing the cost as well as the efficiency. I think that's, Madam Chair, that's where I'm looking at going is I think this is a great program with conservation, but how do we look at generation reducing the cost and dealing with greenhouse gas emissions, but also on the campuses looking at energy storage and sequestration with tree planting, prairie plantings, less turf grass.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Hansen. So I do know in two of our projects for both DNR and Leech Lake, they did actually do solar as part of the entire package. Every project is unique, right? So some just simply won't pencil out. At least using the framework of an energy savings contract, they might be able to do it in another, with another vehicle or means, but certainly it is a possibility that we've tried to work in where possible. But we will be sure to get additional information back to the committee on the scope and potential. Thank you.
Representative Constance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if there's an average time for the payback.
Ms. Franzi.
Good morning. There is not a specific average time for payback, although most of the projects we're seeing in the 15 to 18 year. Now, I am advised that that might sound like, wow, why 15 to 18 years? You want to go after an ROI of 3 to 5, that type of thing. But the unique nature of GESP is that you're pairing it with those that have the 2022 year that have experienced all this deferred maintenance, pairing that with the 3 to 5 year so that you get everything within a... Where would you like me to start? But pairing it, then it you land in that 15 year realm.
That wasn't me, Madam Chair.
We have 2 minutes left.
Okay.
She has 3 slides left.
Never mind.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be cognizant of the time. So we'll move quickly to slide 7. This just gives more detail on the kinds of measures allowed and how the financing works. I will note projects have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, right? So where we have state general obligation bonds within the building, it does limit the type of improvements we can do just based on another constitutional and statutory limitation. So that limitation has caused some delays and a learning curve, which earlier in the project tenure, and we're working on administrative fixes to try to figure that out. We'll move to the next slide. On the benefits of using GESP contracting. So here's a couple key benefits. So we do open book pricing. So that means that there isn't a prescribed methodology that folks have to go by, which means we can negotiate that, right, and hopefully get a better deal. There's also competitive bidding of trade work, and that's resulted in significant savings. MSU Mankato saved almost $1 million, Leech Lake saved over $600,000, right, so the competitive nature of that is helpful. You've heard from Minnesota State on this, so we'll move quickly to share some specific results on the next slide, 2 slides. You've heard about Riverland Community College. I just want to note 27% electricity savings over 4 campus buildings. They got that work done. They got work that they couldn't get done within their current operating budget. That's the game changer here. And we're opening up funding for other critical needs, right? You can spend the money not on your utility bills, but something else. The next slide shows some results for Mankato State. They have actually are a multiple award winner, including from Environmental Initiative. They won the Sustainability Leader Award. They're the second largest campus in the state, 15,000 students. And to a point I heard earlier, these energy savings measures are the equivalent of taking 10,000 cars off the road every year. Recognizing time, we'll go to the last slide. So this is a restatement of some of the features of the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program. We absolutely recognize there is more that could be done, and we are strong partners along with Department of Administration and MMB in figuring out how we can always simplify processes and accelerate work. So I want to name that as an ongoing priority for the Department of Commerce, and we look forward to bringing more projects and more success stories to you in the future, and we'd be happy to stand for questions.
Great. And perhaps at another time we will be able to answer them and have them again. It tied in very nicely with presentations and the needs of the funding to maintain buildings and asset preservation and all that. And so we wish you well.
Thank you.
As you go forward. You. Representative Graswell, you have a correction to make on the printed minutes.
Oh, yes,
that
I'm
you
sure.
Are excused. You were excused. Thank you. And then you wish to
just make a motion to amend the minutes to correct it to be excused, Madam Chair. I just simply forgot to send an email to if I had a prior engagement.
That's fine. And so Representative Graswell moves the adoption of the minutes as explained. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Amendment. The minutes are adopted as printed with Representative Graswell's name under excuse. This meeting is adjourned.